Glenn Haight here with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program, and welcome to our Fish Biz Workshop Series. Today is March 3rd, and we're looking at the subject of business succession today. And generally what we're going to be talking about is how an individual who has a lot of assets in their business, in their fishing business, can move those assets to other individuals, be it family, son or daughter, or someone who they know and have worked with a long time in the fishing industry, or just out in the general market. We want to look at the various components of that and provide some information for folks who are approaching this time in life. Special thanks today to all the technicians that are out there. We've got a neat group that have joined us today, and I'll do introductions here in a bit, but we're connecting to Petersburg, Alaska, and we're connecting to Iowa State. Oh, there's Sunny in Petersburg. Hello, Sunny. And we're connecting into Iowa, and I think it's Urbandale, but big thanks to Iowa State University and their extension there. We've got Dave Baker, who's online with us, and we'll introduce Dave here in a little bit. But can I get the PowerPoint up? Okay, hopefully you can read this. This is the quick little summary of what we'll be covering today. We'll first look at the subject of goal alignment and the kinds of things you want to look at, and then we'll cover the various components of transferring a business, business planning, retirement planning, transfer planning, and estate planning. I guess the word plan shows up a lot here. Okay. If we could click forward, thank you. First slide we have is my information. I'm going to skip on me today. If anyone hasn't watched one of these classes yet, you can go to a past class and catch the information on me. But you have the contact information if you want to get a hold of me, 907-796-6046. Okay. And I'll move it on there. And I am with the Alaska Marine Advisory Program, which is part of Sea Grant, which is part of the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, and we belong to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Now, we're here in Juneau today at the University of Alaska Southeast campus and of course, broadcasting from coming from Petersburg and also Iowa. Okay. We have got three guests today, and the first I want to introduce Sunny Rice, and Sunny is our Petersburg agent, and there's some contact information for Sunny. Of course, you can find all this on the Marine Advisory Program website. Sunny specializes in a number of things, and one of the things that she's done serving in Petersburg is really started to focus in on this issue of business succession, because it has been noted in the community of Petersburg as an issue. There's a lot of people, longtime fishermen in the community who have really amassed a lot of wealth through their operation, and as they move to the point of retirement, they're looking around and wanting to pass this on and keep it in the community, but because of the high cost, it's not so easy to find folks that can actually afford to buy this. So it has become an issue, and Sunny's done a lot of research on it and put a publication together. Sunny, are you do we have you?
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Any opening remarks for the gang today?
No, I'm really excited to be talking about this topic. Like you said, it's been important here in this community, and I think all around the state. More and less complicated transfers take place depending on how large the fishing businesses are. But the issue of keeping access to fishing resources located and home ported in rural communities is important. All over the state, and particularly important here. And it's also going to be great to tie into what's going on for farmers, because it's pretty impressive what's available out there. So I'm looking forward to having David talk to us, too.
Okay, great. Thank you. Nice segue. And our next guest presenter is Dave Baker. And Dave is with the Beginning Farmers Center, and he's with Iowa State University. I didn't put that up there, Iowa State University Extension. And there's some contact information for him. Now, in Iowa, you know, there's a number of areas that are pretty advanced in this discussion of moving farms within a community and within generations. And Iowa is one of the leaders in this. And I guess Dave can explain it better. We'll explain it better than I. But they really have developed some infrastructure, if you will, some program infrastructure to help people move their farms within families and within communities. So Dave, are you there? And welcome, and thanks for joining. Can I ask you to make an opening remark or two?
I did have to travel from the office down in Urbandale, Iowa, which is by Des Moines, up to the home of the Cyclones, which is Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. So I'm broadcasting from Ames. Got some great IT people here helping as well. But yes, the similarities between transitioning farm operations to the next generation is just so amazing with what you and the fisheries business have. Because of the value of your equipment, the value of the farmland that we see, and just the trouble that the older generation has with trying to decide how they can keep their business ongoing and yet still slow down, find other careers, find other things to be doing as far as slowing down a little bit, relaxing a little bit more, and turning that over to the younger people that have a little bit more energy. A lot of labor is involved in fishing as well as farming. So today, I guess we just hope to transfer some of our information, some of our research that we've done with farm families and how they've gone about transferring their farm operations from one generation to the next. Because it is so important for our rural communities that they can help stabilize their economic base, which is basically farm operations and farm income. So,
thank you, Dave. And can I just ask, while we're just talking in general about what you folks are doing, what are some of the kinds of day-to-day activities that you might engage in there? I know you do workshops and one-on-one counseling. What in general do you see in the course of a work week or work month? If you could describe that.
You bet. The two main programs that we have are the AgLink program, which we work with farm families that are bringing a son or a daughter or another relative back to their farm operation because of the needs of expansion or just transferring the business to the next generation because of the retirement of the older generation or possibly because of bad health of that first generation. So we do a lot of family consultations. We do some mediations with family members. We probably do one or two per week where I travel across the state of Iowa and meet with families that have run into roadblocks, that need a neutral party to come in and just visit about what this succession plan needs to accomplish to bring in that next generation. The second part of our center, Beginning Farmer Center, deals with the Farm On program, where we actually try and match up young people that would love to have an opportunity to farm but don't otherwise see any opportunities with retirement age individuals within 5 to 10 years of retirement that might not have a son or daughter coming back to that farm, but it's a very viable business. And so it's kind of like eHarmony for farmers, where we have a computerized database of young applicants, and we match those up with the retirement site individuals and more or less facilitate interviews, starting out with a phone interview and then going to a personal interview on the farm with these parties, and try and walk them through the steps of transitioning that business to a non-related party. And that's been just expanded widely in the last couple years because of our website. We receive a lot of calls from outside the state of Iowa, from young people that would love to come to Iowa and join existing farm operations here. So I do stay busy doing a lot of marketing of our program. We are actually funded by the state of Iowa, part of ISU Extension. It's just another service that we offer to the citizens of this state. We actually do a lot of conferences, breakout sessions. I will be traveling to Denver in June to put on a presentation for the Risk Management Agency, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. So the need is there to spread the word as far as the research that's been done by many different universities, and especially by those members of the International Farm Transition Network, which also has their own website, which we are a member of. So.
Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it. That's very helpful. And that sort of leads nicely into our introduction for our next presenter, and because a lot of You know, in my research of this of the subject and looking at what's out there, particularly in the farm community, I ran across some workshop videos that were done with Oregon State University and a number of subjects that were covered, and in many of them, it was really important to grab experts in the field, specialists that work in various segments. And so I was pleased to get Randy Hirt to join us today with Stellar Financial. Randy is in Juneau here. Randy joined us last fall when we did a workshop on planning for retirement. So it's great to have Randy back. And I didn't realize this until we all got together as presenters the other day, but that Randy is actually a University of Iowa Hawkeye, yes?
Yes.
And Dave is the Cyclone. So we all still seem to get along pretty well. But we had a Big Ten clash there. But anyways, Randy, thanks for joining. And any just general thoughts you have on this opening point?
Sure. The that uninterested party or someone that can visit with a group. A fisherman, maybe in his family, or possibly his partner, and have somebody, just as David talked about, bringing in somebody that can really bring up issues that maybe the partner or the son maybe wouldn't want to bring up on his own. For instance, hey, Dad, you know, you're 75, you know, you've got a bad heart. We need to think about, you know, what's going to happen, not only if you died tomorrow out on the boat, but also you know, what do you really want to happen? Your mom's still alive. We got to take care of her. What are the issues as far as if we do sell the business, if we sell it, piecemeal it out to a family member or to a partner, really, where we go from there? What are the taxation issues? What if we don't do anything? Those are issues that I think having an outside party at least come in and explore and really kind of be able to put yourself, at least I try to put myself in the place of each person and say, what would be a question that I'd want to ask that maybe I'd feel a little uncomfortable asking my partner, my father, my grandfather. Those are tough things, and I think having someone else bring those up, certainly with a little bit of expertise. We don't do business succession every day, but over 20 years, there's a lot of similarities between obviously fishing and farming, but also other types of businesses that really have the same issues.
And one thing, Randy, that you do is on occasion you have some clients that are in fisheries, and so that's very helpful to have you here and maybe share some experiences you might have seen in the process of working with folks. So thanks for joining.
Welcome.
Okay, before we jump into it, I was hoping to run through some administrative stuff here that we usually do every week, but if I could get you to hit the... thank you. Okay, so we are coming through on UATV today, and that is a service from the University of Alaska Southeast. I'm going to click on the site here and just pull it up for folks to take a look at. Okay, it is http://... uatv.alaska.edu. Now, UATV is available in a number of different formats. You can you can go online actually and watch it live either on Unreal Player or on Windows Media. Okay, so whatever they're playing at that time, you can go and watch. It is also available now. I'm going to click on this. I want my UATV. It's also available on a number of cable channels throughout Alaska. So, by using UATV, we're able to get to a lot of places that would normally cost a lot to travel to. So that's a real neat service, and we're happy to be here with the folks today. While we are working in the class today, there are two ways that you can contact us if you'd like to. There is a phone number. It's 888-219-2596. Let me slow down and do that again. It's 888-219-2596. So if you want to call in and ask a question, you can give that number a call, and it'll come to the folks in the back here, and they can bring your voice to the rest of us here. We also have a live messenger service where you can log on. If you've registered for the class already, you can hop online to the on-class site, and once you're in the live messenger service, you can type questions. I'll see that pop up here on the site, and then I'll be able to relay that to everyone here. So let me show you that very quickly, and by doing that, I will show you the online class site. Let's see here. So this is the class site. And again, you do need to register in order to get access to this. And I can easily, you can register through the Alaska Marine Advisory Program website. And you can also just give me a call or email me and I'll send you the link. But we're trying to keep track of numbers for this particular series. If you go to the top blue bar, it says Live Messenger. Okay, you see my arrow there. I'm clicking on that. And ask you to enter your location. And I don't know, let's go King Salmon today. Of course, you'll actually enter where you are, but I'm just typing in King Salmon. And then down here, it says add participant and add guest name, and we'll just type in Glenn as in King Salmon. Okay, so that's about as fancy as it gets, and you're on. So again, if you want to log on and just ask some questions through this live messenger service, that's the way to do it. Okay, I'm going to go back to the home site just briefly here and walk people through that in the event they have not seen it, and show you some of the things we do. I keep it pretty simple, but the main thing to look at is this class resources section with the green bar. Each of the sessions that we've done so far are kept here, and if you click on any of them, I'll just go to the one we did on the February 10th, starting the Seafood Cooperative. You'll see that it has all the material that was offered up for that particular class, including web links and publications. It also has the PowerPoint guide that we follow that particular day, and then I'm able to also put the workshop video for that particular session up with that material. So you'll see, after today, you'll see the video, the workshop video listed under March 3rd for this particular session. I want to cover just briefly some of the information that we have here. Again, we'll always have a PowerPoint document. It's up here right away. And then I do have a link to the Beginning Farmer Center in Iowa State University. And again, they've got a lot of material on there that can help folks out. I have a web link to Sunny's publication, How to Make a Directed Transfer of Your Fishing Business. I did include this Oregon State University Extension Business Succession segment, which is pretty neat. And then the University of Minnesota's Regional Extension Educator Service, I'm not sure if I said that right, but put out a guide to transfer planning. Okay, and this is just one of many documents that this group has put out. So you have right away three extension groups in the U.S. that are putting together a lot of really helpful material for the farming industry, and the parallels are striking for fisheries. So I would encourage you to check that out. One thing we're going to do in the class today, after we've talked generically about some of these subjects, is we're going to try to do a case study, kind of an exercise, if you will, to try to bring some of these things to some of these concepts and work subjects that we talk about, try to bring them into more of a common situation. So if you're just watching this live or in recorded form, I'd encourage you to put it on, if you're watching it recorded, put it on pause. If you're watching it live, try to go to the online site there and pull up these case study handouts, if you will, and take a look at them. Some of them are a lot of Excel documents and numbers, and they're hard to read over the TV. So if you have them in your hand, that'll make it a little bit easier. Okay. So that's some of the administrative stuff we have here. Now, I don't know that we'll last the entire time today, but we will. But we'll go as far as we can. And if we run a little bit short, that's fine. But we'll just see how it goes. Okay. Now I'm gonna hit you with a quote. Like we usually start off with one. This one's a pretty simple one. Don't simply retire from something; have something to retire to. By Harry Emerson Fosdick. And now he was a gentleman who lived about a century ago, I think. Oh no, he died in 1969. But influential minister in I think New York area. But a good opening quote for us today. Don't simply retire from something; have something to retire to. Okay, I just want to start off the conversation, and I'll generally start each of the slides, and then we'll move to people throughout the various areas. So for those who are watching this, expect maybe a little bit of interruption and pause here and there. We also may be having some sunspot outages or something like that. So if you happen to be watching on satellite, and all of a sudden you no longer have reception, it should come back on in 10 minutes or so. I hope that's not going to be a problem for anyone, but we have been warned. Okay, so I wrote the first thing is succession of a problem. And the problem, it's a social issue in that, and as Dave touched on, it certainly it was felt in the farm industry in the 1980s when price of land went skyrocketing. It was difficult for young individuals to get into the farm industry. You can see the response that's come from these extension agents across the country in these areas. They have put a lot of material and a lot of time into helping keep economic activity that's land-based, that's food-based, keep it in locals' hands and try to maintain a strong rural economy. It's often viewed as an important thing in a number of different in many governments, very important to maintain that strong rural base, strong rural economy. And so that's what's happened in agriculture. And we have seen, I think, a reason for that in the fishing industry. There is, with a lot of privatization efforts, and I guess you could start off with CFEC and limited entry in the 70s, you know, had some effect in terms of privatizing the resource. But the cost to get a permit, with the exception of a few fisheries, wasn't too terribly difficult, and there was enough loan programs around to help people get into those. So I don't think that really dislocated young folks from entering. But now that we have things like the IFQ program for halibut and for sable fish, it is really expensive to get into the fishery. Now I didn't have a chance to check this, and so maybe you folks out there can check my math on this, but of course, in 1995, the halibut IFQ program was kicked off, and anyone with historic history was given the quota shares. And the numbers I drew up here suggest that, for instance, in Area 3A, okay, that's just on the east side of the Gulf of Alaska, the average number of shares an Alaskan had was about 48,000. Okay, that was in 1995. By 2007, the average shares for Alaskans in 3A was 86,000, so almost more than doubled the amount of shares held by an average individual. And of course, in that time, the number of people working in the IFQ fishery have dropped. I had some numbers of that. Oh yes, here in 1995, the number of boats fishing was 2,057. By 2007, the number was 1,200. So you see a huge consolidation and an accumulation of quota by individuals. Now, again, this is what I'd like any of you guys watching to check my math on. For 2007, I came up with a general market value for IFQ in the neighborhood of all of it together, all in Alaska, 2C, all the 3s and all the 4s, of about $1.2 billion. Okay, that's the cost, the market cost of all of the shares outstanding. And so individuals will own easily, certain individuals will own several million dollars worth of IFQ if they fished for a long time, had a strong gifting in the beginning, and now have accumulated IFQ to the maximum amounts. They will have millions of dollars. And some of them are quite interested in keeping that in their communities. And so that's sort of the nature of what we're looking at in the fishing industry and reason for us to take a page out of the farm industry and try to develop a little more information for folks to work with. Okay, I kind of yammered on there for a while. Does anyone else have anything to add to that? Out and about, Sonny or Dave, Randy?
I think, you know, when I look at those numbers, I certainly think about what's happening with estate taxes, and that's why a lot of family farms were lost at times, was because of the value of the land became a taxable event after a person's death. The IRS stepped in and, you know, gives the credit, but after that you have a estate tax that goes up to 55%. So starts at about 35. So when you start thinking about a guy who's worth a couple million with his IFQs, that's not counting his boat, his other permits, his house, his life insurance, and his other retirement accounts. So those are things I think about when I start hearing about the explosion of the value of some of these permits. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened with farms where people wanted to pass them down to their kids. But unfortunately, you know, after paying the IRS a large amount, they had to break it up and sell it.
I'd like to just step in there and mention that because of the different tax laws that we have today, so many things have changed, but the imperative thing is that people plan this out. When they start talking about retirement or talking about different activities that they're going to have in their life and different lifestyles, that's when it comes to be so important that they talk to their children, talk to their tax practitioners, talk to their bankers about planning out this retirement so that they, the IRS doesn't feel like they're going to get half the estate or 55%. Right now we have a $3.5 million exemption that deals with large estates. So for most of our farm operations, that's going to be more than enough to exempt another family member getting into that business. So I guess I'm not going to spend the time going into all the different tax laws, but I want to just stress that communication, talking about it, planning it out, talking with your children are going to be talking about it with each other. So if there's multiple siblings, you can bet most of the siblings have an interest in what happens with the assets that mom and dad have. So when mom and dad get to be in their retirement years, I want them to be excited about going on to the next step in their lives, not feeling that they're being kicked out or that they have to retire. It's going to be their choice, first and foremost. But I'd like to have them plan it out if they would like to be doing something else. Let's plan it out to where we can successfully bring that next generation in.
Thank you. Okay. Sonny, I don't know if you have any comments, but I'll move on unless I hear you jump in. Okay, next thing to take a quick look at is the kind of general options a person may have when they approach this issue. Say you're 5 years out, say you're 10 years out of your retirement date. What are you going to do? Okay, some of the general options that we have are transfer to your family or within your family. And Dave just touched on some of the difficulties with that. I mean, who in your family, and what are the other ones going to get, and how is it going to go down? It's very important. Another issue is selling within your community. If that's important to you, how do you go about doing it? Do we have eHarmony here in Fisheries? I don't know that we do, but that's kind of a neat idea, but hard to get to if we don't have it. Sell to the highest bidder, and I think that's probably what a lot of people are going to do. They're going to put their IFQ up there. They're going to put their boat on a broker list, and they're going to see what they get. Okay. Now, this other one, sell at death, is an interesting one that we talked about in meeting together, and that would be your default, if you will. You just don't do anything. You just fish until you're done, and then of course, it's a difficult issue for folks to pick up on at that point. And then the idea of slowly cutting back and slowly selling off your assets as you go, which is, I think, better done if done under a plan. Anyone have any additions to this general list, or?
Yeah, Glenn?
Okay, yep.
Yeah, I guess the options there of selling within the community or transferring to your family were the ones that have been motivating folks around here to look at this in a more planned method. I mean, there are tax implications if you just sell to the highest bidder as well, but it gets a little bit more complicated. It takes more time and forethought. If you have concerns, perhaps just beyond your own financial interest into your family or your community, and how those will all fit together.
Yeah, and the case study that we're going to cover later on is going to revolve around that. And I think a lot of the information we have here is going to maybe assume that direction. So thanks, honey. Okay, so I think what I'd like to do on this, as we get into this, is turn it over pretty quickly to Dave, because Dave really does emphasize, how important some of these bullets are, talking about goal setting, talking about communication, and talking about trust. When you get into family succession, or what I'm calling here targeted succession, where you have an individual that maybe has been a crew member for a while, or worked with you for a long time. What are the general things just to get started that you're going to want to take a look at, and how do you lay that out? So maybe Dave, I could ask you to kick off some discussion on this particular piece.
You bet. I guess your last slide where you talk about selling at death and selling within the community. I think the retirement age individual needs to remember that if they have wishes for their farm business, for their fishing business, that in order for those wishes to come true, they need to work on those ahead of time. They cannot wait till they are gone. If they have a plan in their head, they need to start writing it down, sharing that plan with other family members, with other stakeholders of that business. And I think we talk about selling items, selling this, but to me it's more of a transferring. You're going to be receiving income upon the sale or upon the rent of whether it be quotas or whether it be farmland, whether it be machinery. So there are many tax implications to doing that when you're in your retirement years, because at 65, most individuals are, have the right to retirement benefits. So when you start planning out your retirement, I think it's important that you determine whether the business that you're transferring has enough income, first of all, for that next family that's going to be coming into the business, as well as your needs as you start to retire. So that's one of the first questions we discuss with families is that farm or is that fishing business big enough, large enough to handle a second second family, a second individual? And then next, is that next individual, the younger individual, is he truly determined to make this work? Is that something he really wants to do? And I think we've seen a shift within the ag community for sure over the last 40, 50 years from a case where the oldest male of the family was just expected to come back and take over the family farm. I think as we came through the farm crisis of the 80s, we've seen many families have had to rely on other options as far as who's going to take over the family farm, because many of the children have gone off and pursued other careers, have gotten some great educations at colleges and other institutions, and developed careers within the business world away from that farm. So and that might be another reason to communicate with your siblings to find out, well, who would be interested within that family of taking over the family farm. They might have been away from the farm for 3, 4, 5 years, but have a desire to come back. So that's where we need to have the families discussing, what are the possibilities? And at the whole time, I still like to stress that retirement age individual needs to look at this as some possibly exciting times where they're going to be able to relieve themselves some of the stress and pressures of a farm business and turn some of that over to the younger generation while they can enjoy the later years in life with hopefully enough income to support the two families. A lot of times you look at expansion of a farm business or a fishing business. I think those are all things that, Randy mentioned having a neutral party come in and bring up those questions, bring up that discussion. Because many of these families find it's awkward to talk about estate planning and business planning. Well, to me, estate planning is pretty simply drafting a will. Who's going to get what upon my death? Well, to me, it goes, when you're talking about business transitions, it goes well beyond that into develop a plan that the successor can come in and be successful at taking over an existing business and not always doing it in the same manner that Dad did. There's going to be things that they're going to have available, new technology, quite costly technology. So we're hopeful that older generation can add some breaks from time to time for the younger generation that maybe is more anxious to really go gung-ho and spend some high-dollar amounts to buy that technology, where the older generation is saying, well, I think you can get by with a little bit less. Watch your debt level. And to me, that mentoring of that next generation is so important. So, in other words, communication, planning it out, having written plans, having a timeline, put down on paper, I wish to slowly get out of farming within the next 5 or 10 years or 15, whatever is your choice. It needs to be flexible, where if health issues might arise within the 5 years, how can we change it? How can we tweak it to make it work? Instead of just dropping the whole plan. So, most of these things we go over with the families when they're bringing in that next generation. Yes, as far as keeping the business within the community, it's awful easy when you've got farmland surrounding a community. But it goes beyond that to where it's actually a farm business that might have livestock. You've got a set of machinery. Those are the types of transfers we're talking, in addition to the farm business. There's many different segments to transferring this business. As well, I'm sure it's the same with a fishing business. You've got your ships, your boats. You've got your fishing equipment. You've got your quotas. So if a person wants to see that continue, it does take some proper planning, and it does take time. So and then the whole time keeping track of what the government has done with new regulations.
Okay. Does anyone else have anything to add? Before I've got a few questions, but I'd like to wait until see if anyone else has anything. Randy, do you have any?
You know, I think, you know, when you're sitting down with someone, it's nice to be dealing with somebody that you've got a trust with, for instance, your accountant or your attorney, your banker, financial planner, whoever it is. It is nice to, you know, be visiting with someone that you truly trust. I think that's very important when you're trying to bring your family members in and really trying to get facts out on the table and try to make sure everyone, we don't hurt any feelings, but certainly you want not to have any ulterior motives going on with like a son bringing, for instance, his financial person in to talk to dad. And that sometimes won't work as well because that trust issue maybe isn't there. So yeah, I think that's something to certainly think about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sonny, do you have a question? Or, excuse me, Sonny, do you have anything to add to this? One question that I've got here, and just I'll put it out to the group, is when you've been counseling in the past and working with them, whether it's a fishing operation or something else, in terms of succession planning, what are kind of the danger areas? What kind of traps do you see people fall into a lot where it really causes some real disruption, some real problems? What should people look out for?
I think what I find, not particularly just fishing businesses, but a lot of type of businesses where you've got maybe a difference of opinion about the competence of the elder person, whether, you know, hey, I've heard kids talk about their dad's, you know, being, you know, about their dad's inheritance they're going to get, and the dad's 55. And you also find times where, you know, well, dad's not doing as good a job as I could do out there. And a lot of it, you know, I would have to say is it's very difficult because you've got someone who is at towards the end of their life. Hopefully they're going to be excited about the next stage, but a lot of times their business has been their life. I mean, you know, I don't want to say anything about, you know, people who work in government or work for someone, but when you are a business owner, I mean, you've got, it becomes more your life and not just an 8-to-5 job. So talking to someone about leaving their employment as a teacher after 30 years is a much different subject as when you start talking about a business owner giving up control of something he's built from nothing. And maybe someone pushing him in a direction, whether it be his wife, one of his kids, his partner, maybe a planner, maybe his doctor, who knows. But sometimes the time isn't right. They just don't feel, you know, they feel like they have more years in them. That's where, as Dave said, stretching that out to, okay, do you think you'll still be wanting to fish when you're 120? No, I would think before then I'll probably, okay, well, you're 75. You know, over what period of time do you think you want to ease back in and give control off to someone? Well, probably by 85. Okay, we at least have a 10-year time frame to work with. Because they are giving up, for a lot of people, their life. And I think it takes a lot of time to think about, you know, giving up that control, and then what? So that first quote you had, having something to retire to, maybe they need a 4 or 5 years to even think about that. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So the sooner you bring it up, I think the better. It is better to have an outside person that you trust bring it up and talk about it. And that's where I think what Dave's doing up there in Iowa is just great.
It sounds like it's a very personal thing. I mean, that may be why, Dave, that you talk so much about the need to sit down and exchange opinions or exchange of strategies or desires or goals. I have this, one of the things that connected me to Dave's shop was a publication they put out, Making a Success of Succession Planning Using the Critical Path Method. And in that, I think they do spend a fair amount of time talking about the owner sitting down with the successor and really working out what their vision is, what their values are, what their missions are, and to see if there is some similarities and some shared goals there. Dave, is that sort of the vision with Critical Path, or how does that work, and how has that been implemented for you?
Well, the Critical Path method that we use actually puts a timeline for our planning, because we all know that there's going to be certain steps that have to take place before you accomplish set goals. You're going to have many small goals within this time frame, so that at the end of this process, you have actually transferred the business. So by putting it in a critical path, we actually write down what different things have to happen. Okay, in the instance of transferring farmland or quotas, you do need to notify certain people that this part of my business will have a new fisherman within the family, a new farmer within the family. So whether you're talking to your banker, other landowners that you might rent from, those are part of the path that you're going to be taking. That younger person has to set up a financing system where he's going to be able to take over that end of the business. He has to have an education. So if someone is 13, 14 years old, wants to come back and join dad on the farm, most wise dads say, well, I want you to get a good education first. So that's one of the steps in this critical path, that we train that young person into how to take over this farm business, which many times today deal with millions of dollars per year in budgets. So one of the other trouble spots that I've run into many times is where there's just a lack of communication. Dad and mom might talk about it a little bit, but very few of those businessmen are wide open about communicating their business plans with anybody. And this includes the bankers, the lawyers, their CPA. Once in a while, you'll hear a little bit of coffee shop talk between individuals. But for the most part, there's a shortage of communication, and there's a lot of assumptions made many times by the father or by the son, that he expects him to take over, and the son is assuming that dad wants me to take over. And then we run into the problems with, you have several siblings, and the one stays home on the farm and helps dad and runs the business for 5-10 years, and all of a sudden dad says, well, you can just have the farm. Well, that you can bet the other siblings that are part of that family are wondering, well, what does that mean for me when something does happen to you? And, you know, Brother Johnny's got the title to the whole farm and the farm business. Does that mean that there's no inheritance for me? Or you run into problems where you've treated Johnny, you know, better than the rest of us. How is that fair? So many times we get into discussions as treating our children in an equitable manner as opposed to an equal manner. Because that's got the other side, too, where if little Johnny's going to inherit one-fourth or one-fifth of these farm assets, how is he possibly going to buy out the other three-fourths or four-fifths of the other siblings that have inherited this farm operation and still continue on? Because of the prices of land or fishing boats or quotas, it'd be almost impossible for that one person that stayed there with the business to buy out the other siblings without having something set up as far as maybe life insurance or other assets that can go to that other sibling. So right back to communication, talking to your family, talking to other, I call them stakeholders, people that are familiar with your business. And I also mentioned, you know, that bringing in a neutral party. And I think that's what sometimes adds a lot of credibility to what I say, is because I've been a farmer for 30 years. I've been there. I've been in the business. I've actually taken over farm business as a young person, and I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I'm going to, in the next 5 or 10 years, plan out the transfer of my farm operation to the next generation. So having been on both sides, when I visit with families, they can sense that right away, that I know what I'm talking about. I've seen problems arise, and by talking about it with someone that has no skin in the game, just willing to talk to the family and say, have you talked about this? Have you thought about this? That's what helps to get them through in a more successful manner. So,
thank you. Sunny?
Yeah, just a couple small things to add. One is the issue of capital construction funds, and I think maybe we'll touch on that in a minute. But as you're going into it, I can see that being a pitfall for folks, capital construction funds that they've not forgotten about but haven't used and don't intend to use going back into their fishing business as they own it. And just one other note, there are a couple, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission has a specific form, I don't know if folks know about this, where you can designate a permit recipient upon the holder's death, and you can also designate a beneficiary for your quota or IFQ form through the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Thank you, Sunny. Do you know what sort of the tax ramifications are of that? Is it a tax-free thing, do you know?
If you were going to make one of these designations via the CFEC or the National Marine Fisheries Service? I don't think that has anything to do with whether or not it's a tax-free transfer. It's just a way that you can designate it in some ways as sort of will, not in place of a will, but you can let it be known to the official agencies that hold your permit or your access to the quota that you have this specific individual in mind.
Great. Thank you. That makes sense.
On that, if I might be able to comment on that.
Generally, when assets are taken as, and that's where sometimes dying with the asset as an IFQ, as long as it wasn't too much money, there's really no, you get a step up in value in most assets, meaning if I got the IFQs for free and I sell them to my son, I might have to be responsible for capital gains. Whereas if I leave them to my will through a benefactor like this, there really wouldn't be any income tax on it. So it's my guess would be, and there are some advantages to making sure you do have probably a beneficiary, maybe even a contingent beneficiary in case you and your spouse died in the same accident. So there probably wouldn't be any, at death, any income tax. It's just the estate tax we'd be looking at.
Okay, the next...
Federal law has... I was just going to talk about the differences in state laws. That's why it's so important to have legal advice when doing this paperwork, this planning, to make sure that we do it according to the different state laws and the federal law as far as what can be transferred, what transfers upon death. Many times we have farm families that actually transfer land between... to your spouse, where your spouse has lifetime use of the income off that farm, but the children would eventually inherit that farm and then could actually take it over that way without facing some large taxes.
Thanks. Great. Okay. The next option that one could go for here, and we'll just take these quickly and talk about them just in general. Is put out to the highest bidder, and this is probably pretty common, I think, in fisheries. But it may require breaking up the assets of the fishing operation, or trying to sell as a whole. And Randy and I were just talking about this before we got started here. How sometimes that can be really difficult in a fishing industry because the individual, really the fisherman, is the heart and soul of the business, and the success or failure has a lot to do with that individual, how well they fish, if they know where the fish are, how hardworking do they want to hit it. I mean, a lot of things are really directed at the individual. So quite often you see that the assets are broken up and sold separately. And of course, you're going to be subject to market conditions at the time at the time you try to sell. So there's that component of it as well. But it's an option that a lot of people do. So, any comments on that? Now here's one that we can just touch on briefly. We talked about earlier is the sell at death option, really. So it's a default strategy, and I thought it might leave your heirs at a disadvantage if they receive a lot of property, a lot of assets from you, and end up having to pay taxes on a lot of those, that they might actually have to go into some trouble of their own to try to accomplish that for you. So it's probably not the best option if you can avoid it. It may not be the most cost effective. Any comments? Just let me know.
I guess I'm not sure how the quotas price would affect the inheritance, but with farmland and farm assets, if you are the son or the daughter of the owner, the one that has passed away, there would not be any tax implications to that person, because they do actually get a stepped up basis on those assets. So until they were to sell them, and there would be a difference in appreciation of the value, you would not be facing any tax complications. So,
Dave, would that be income tax situation versus maybe estate taxes?
As far as income taxes, I guess I'm not sure your question, but to me, that individual would be inheriting assets through an inheritance. And as a son or daughter, they would not pay inheritance tax on that, and there would be no income tax on it because it had already been taxed as a value at some point to the older generation.
Sure. Okay. Interesting. Okay. All right, and now I want to just get into the general components of what we've been talking about here, and including business planning, estate planning, transfer planning, and retirement planning. The first one is the area of business planning. We talk about business plans a lot, and usually when I've talked about them, it's in the context of looking at the potential viability of a new business venture, perhaps, or if you're in a fishing operation, perhaps it's looking at buying into some expensive IFQ over here, or perhaps a new boat, or a brand new type of fishery where you're not so certain. And certainly a direct market operation would be one where an individual would want to have a carefully scoped out business plan before they jumped into it. But in here we're talking about the idea of business succession, and so it's not so always so much about a new thing, but the slow path, maybe sometimes quick, but the path of moving out your assets in the direction that you want them to go. So it's still using that business plan model as a way to do that and capture those particular goals that individuals have. So we talk about establishing goals in the business plan when you're doing a business succession. It would incorporate the transfer plan. Okay, business plan may not really touch so much on the estate plan, perhaps it would, but it certainly will talk about how those assets will be transferred out. And one thing it does as an advantage is it can communicate with your other business partners, like your lenders, who are very interested in the long-term success of your business. For instance, your banker might want to know if you will continue in operation, and if they can look at this business plan and see that you and your successor have carefully crafted a plan to maintain the viability of the business, that may help them and therefore keep a strong banking relationship intact. That's maybe just one of the good reasons of doing a business plan. So. Anyone, I'll open it up for any other thoughts on this area.
Glenn, could I add something here? The idea of sitting down with, I guess, particularly I'm thinking about if it's somebody's child, sitting down and working out a written plan, looking at the future of your business is not only making a plan so that this transfer will happen successfully, but it's passing on those business skills to that next generation. And so that was a pitfall that I wanted to mention earlier, was just in addition to passing on the assets, this need to pass on the skills, whether they be business skills or fishing skills. And so you're modeling good business skills and good business planning skills by simply entering into this process with your son or daughter or whoever you're planning to transfer the business to. And I think that's an equally as important thing to pass on as the boat and the permits and the quota.
It's a good point. Certainly, in a business plan, you would try to capture the management experience in the business, and to the extent it's touching on a transfer plan or a business succession plan, to have that sort of that training plan, if you want to call it that, but where you're demonstrating how this individual is becoming more proficient at the business sounds like a valuable idea. Letting them know where the fishing grounds are best, that's passing on that kind of wisdom is useful. Okay, any other The other next component is, Dave?
We use some time to do that we set up a time schedule of maybe 5 to 10 years as opposed to let's do this next month. I think those 5 to 10 years are kind of a good rule of thumb to use for whether you've got a fishing business to actually use that time to mentor that next business person, the successor to your business, to make sure over time that he has the tools necessary, he's got the skills necessary, and to allow that older generation to pass those on to that next generation. So very important that we use this as a process. It's not just an event that's going to happen.
Yep, makes sense. Okay, the next area is the subject of retirement planning. And I would this is a big subject, and actually Randy joined me in I think November of last year for a class on this, and you can get that class it's online still for folks if you want to watch a broader discussion of this subject. So it's online at the Alaska Marine Advisory Program, and you go into My Profile and you can find 2008 Business of Fish class, and you click that and you'll find the class that we did there. But retirement planning is a component of what we're talking about here, and it's really where the owner will determine for themselves what they're going to need once they're done fishing, and it can be a pretty complicated effort. It does require you to determine what your future income needs to be when you retire, when you reach that retirement age, and so that you have to budget for your expenses in the future, what you're going to need, and accommodate for that as you go through. You're going to want to look at big events that are going to happen, that are going to be a drain on your resources, be it a vacation around the world or perhaps sending the kids to college that's going to put a drain on your ability to save for retirement. And you've got to look at the risks that are in the market, and we're seeing that right now with the recession that's hitting and how individual savings are getting depleted. That's a big factor out there for this kind of discussion. And then selling the assets that you have as a business. If you intend for your fishing operation to serve as a major component of your retirement, you need to be ready for the potential of a fishery collapse perhaps in your area that might lower the value of your boat and lower the value of the IFQ or permits that you have. So these are all things that you need to think about. And again, that was a very quick discussion, so I'm hoping others might have something to add in this general subject.
I could make a comment on that. I occasionally will find situations where someone's operation, we've looked at the upside of somebody having, like millions of dollars of IFQs and lots of permits and boats, but there are people who right now, maybe they didn't set enough aside for their retirement in the past, and their permits aren't that valuable. So they may be in a situation where they'd like to retire, but they really make more money off of their operation than the permits would even be worth in a year. So there are times where, unfortunately, we reality sometimes hits, and whether it be I just have a troll permit and a boat, but I can make X number of dollars. And if I sold it all tomorrow, I would be out of money in 2 years. Mm-hmm. So there is the other side where, it's not, hasn't been as successful for them over their lives. Maybe they got into it later, but that's certainly, you have to look at income needs, what you're going to receive from Social Security, what you've put away in your previous investments, and then what you could get off the operation if you sold it, and sometimes it may require a few more years of work.
Mm-hmm. What in my discussions with folks about this, I think the point really is to start planning as early as you can. get some money saved away. Okay.
I might just add that when we have family discussions many times with a party that doesn't have an heir to come back to the family farm, we discuss more personal issues like what type of legacy do you want to leave? Is it that you rented out the highest price land in the county, or that you have the largest bank account and you've been quite successful at your business? Is that what's going to follow your name throughout history as being your legacy, or is it maybe more probable that you would be interested in having your legacy be assisting others, helping young people get started in a what can be a very enjoyable type career with agriculture as well as fishing. To me, I see that older generation, to me, looking at that side a little bit harder as being what do they want their legacy to show, that they've assisted others, they've helped others, they've been a mentor to young people. To me, that can probably ring truer than having the largest bank account and selling at the highest price. So even though there are some unique differences between fishing and agriculture, I still see that those family values coming through at the time of retirement and how they want to see their family business transferred on to the next generation. And so a lot of times we'll get into discussions as far as what's really important to that couple that are transferring their farm business to the next generation. And a lot of times you need to make sure that next generation is willing to take on those responsibilities and actually carry that legacy forward. So.
Thank you. All right, the next area, and I guess Dave would probably I'll turn this right back over to you. But while I've got the bullets up here, we're talking about transfer planning, and this is looking at the assets within your business and determining how they're going to move out and at what pace and at what rate. And it's a fairly complicated area that I would be stepping in deep water to get into, because it starts to deal with taxation issues. And that can go a lot of different directions, but it's important to do and sit down with a professional when you're working on something like this. A transfer plan will identify assets, identify who it's going to and how and when. It looks at the various risks that you're transferring and when you're going to be doing that. It requires, again, that, and this is a point that David made, the trust in the relationship, okay, when you engage in transfer planning. And keep things in writing so that it's all fairly clear and fairly organized. Dave, could I turn this one back to you quickly and have you touch on this in more detail?
You bet. I guess I want all those that are listening to be aware that there's so many great tools out there to use in evaluating your business. There's financial analysis packages, software that's available to just do line-by-line entries of assets and liabilities and what it will mean to that next generation to take on those assets and liabilities and how you go about transferring them and how you allot enough income for the retirement side. So keep in mind that with the technology we've got today, there's no excuse for businesses not coming down with a great strategic plan on how to transfer their business, and knowing exactly what the values are and what the implications of transferring that asset to the next generation will be on your lifestyle. So I don't care what size business you are, you should be doing some strategic planning as far as what are the plans for your farm in the future. Do you have the manpower, the human resources available to take that to the next generation? Whether you're a GM, which is probably facing some gigantic obstacles today, or whether you're a small mom-and-pop grocery store in a small rural community, you've got to be able to plan out what's going to happen to that business in the future. The easy way is just to, like you say, call up the auctioneer and say, or the broker, sell my ship, sell my equipment, put money, whatever's left, in the account. Many times you do have tax implications when you're doing that. It's no different than having farm ground, farm machinery. The IRS does take a considerable share of that if it's done before death. So if we're able to plan that out in a strategic manner for that next generation, everybody can be a winner. You know, we can continue to have a family within that community surviving with their own business. We've got so many young people that are anxious to live that kind of lifestyle. They want to be their own boss. But it takes planning. It takes a good education. But with everybody involved, I think it's a doable situation. But yes, as far as software packages, there's so many out there. We use FinPack, which is out of University of Minnesota. And I'll put a plug in for Sunny in the University of Minnesota. Identifying the different aspects tax-wise, as far as income-wise, what that older generation is going to need for income, whether they're going to travel, whether they want to buy a home in town. So what are they going to do with the house on the farm? Does that younger generation want to be living on the farm next to the livestock? The same would be involved in Alaska with a person that owns a fishing business. You're going to have assets that are going to transfer with some tax implications, but most of the time, if it's planned out, you won't face those.
Thanks. Anyone else have any thoughts on this this subject here? Okay.
Just to reemphasize in writing, I think there might be this feeling like you have it all in your head and you've talked about it, and so it's agreed upon, but in writing.
Seem to be critical component. Okay.
We can check back and see what did we write down, and are we closer to our goals? And you can actually monitor it by having it written down. And we don't want it to be set on top of the refrigerator and blow back behind the fridge. We want to know that it's out front. We review it from time to time, whether it's monthly or on an annual basis. You review that, and that's why you've got it written down, so that all the parties can actually read it, and they can count on it as being something you said in the past. It's not just a fleeting thought that was mentioned, out in the middle of a fishing trip, and you say, well, someday this will all be yours. Well, let's get it down on paper so that everyone knows that.
Yep, makes sense. Okay, thank you. The final sort of component here to talk about is estate planning, and this deals with subjects really writing a will out. And again, you want to trust on the use of a professional like an attorney to help you draft that up. But there's a number of things to keep in mind, things like how you'll use trusts, assigning power of attorney, the issue of probate, which I'm not entirely familiar with, but I understand that we want to try to avoid probate if possible. But these are things you can talk to attorneys about, living wills, minimizing your taxes through estate planning, and what kinds of assets you're going to transfer to non-fishing heirs and how you'll approach that. These are all the things that go into estate planning. And again, we've talked about a number of them already, but it's still a critical component of it and an important area. Anyone want to toss some extra comments in on the estate planning?
In the work that I do, I have to be very clear to my clients that I'm not a lawyer, that if they are seeking legal advice, that should come from a practicing lawyer. We do have a lawyer on the staff of Extension that can give them the educational parts, inform them of what the law states. But as far as practicing law and drafting up legal documents, as far as LLCs, LLPs, that needs to be done by their family lawyer. Many times I advise young people to seek out a legal person that's of the same age, for them to start working with a lawyer that maybe is 20, 30 years older. Probably would be a mistake, because they want that lawyer to be still practicing when they get to the point of transferring assets and dealing with their own estate plans. So I never approach these issues with my clients as someone that knows the law and can speak from that angle. You know, I come from the HR side. I talk about the human personality issues and try and work through conflict. Conflict resolution is a big part of my job. So we talked about, you know, the avoiding probate. And I guess that, to me, that's kind of a false idea that we need to avoid probate. I've dealt with several different estate closings within my family in the last year or two. And I think most lawyers would tell you it can end up costing you about the same amount whether your assets are going through probate or not. That their fees are based on the amount of time that they spend not distributing the wealth, but doing it in a legal manner. So I guess I would just comment that avoiding probate doesn't always mean what you think it might mean, that you're going to end up paying maybe the same amount of fees to a lawyer to draft up these documents, make sure it's all done by the law. So that's just a fact of life that we have to deal with, that you know, the government has laws in this country that we need to deal with. There's been a lot of talk in the last few years about developing trust and placing a lot of your assets or all your assets in a trust. Good tools to use, but there again, it's something that your legal experts are going to address and not something that I would address in this transfer planning. I would refer them on to the lawyers for that.
Yep, thank you. Yep. Anyone else? Any quick comments? Okay. Okay, what I want to do now is move into this case study here, and the idea is that what we've done is drafted up a scenario, and then I want to just sort of couch the situation briefly here and run you through the scenario, and then just sort of put the question out to Randy and put the question out to Dave. How would you deal with this? How would you deal with the situation? Sonny has offered to be part of the case study here, and it's Vicky and Arnie Dither here, and so she and I will play that role. We'll ask the questions and that kind of thing, and we'll just see how it flows, and hopefully we'll come up with some interesting thoughts and for people to think about. So what I want to do is quickly run through the case study, and again, if you're watching this in recorded version, it might be good to pause it and go and grab the material off the internet. So the Dithers are a longtime fishing family. Okay, they have children, but the kids may not fish, and they have significant assets. And so the question is, what do they do? Let me get a little more detailed about this here, and just some of the things that the Dithers have. So Arnie is 51, and he's fished for 15 years. This is pretty much what he does. He's married to Vicky, who's 49, and they've been married for a long time, 25 years. They have two children, Samantha and Peter. Now, they live in a small town, Fishburg. Okay, we all know where that is. Oh, by the way, if there's anyone actually out there named Arnie and Vicky Dithers, I apologize. I think I even looked it up to see if there was a Dither in CFEC, and there wasn't. So I think I'm safe. Okay. So they live in Fishburg, which is a small fishing community with a year-round population of 3,500. They want to stay there in the community after retirement, okay? And Arnie thinks he wants to fish until he's about 60, working less as he leads up to retirement. So he's looking at about a 9 to 10-year window and not working as hard as he has at this point. The daughter, Samantha's the oldest, she's 22, and she recently graduated from college with a degree in engineering. Okay, and she's not sure if she wants to come back to Fishburg. Okay, Peter is 17, and he's in his last year of high school. So he's always fished with his dad. He's good at doing it. He understands it pretty well, but he's not sure he wants to do it as a living. He does want to attend college, so it looks like he's going to go do that. So after 4 years of work, Arnie and Vicky have amassed quite a fortune. I'll call it a fortune, but he owns 6 permits, including a Prince William Sound salmon seine permit, Bristol Bay salmon drift, Southeast herring seine, halibut permit statewide, sablefish statewide, and Southeast brown crab. Okay, I'll get into dollars here in a second. He has several hundred shares of halibut and sablefish IFQ, 3 fishing vessels, holdings in several funds, including the capital construction fund. Now, we talked about that earlier. Sonny, you mentioned that. For those that don't know, Capital Construction Fund is a fund that you can create in working with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. That was painful. But the CCF fund allows you to take your income and put it into this fund tax-free. The use of this fund is fairly strict. You have to determine what you want to do with it, and it deals with things like building new boats, perhaps, or reconstruction. Okay, so it has to be fairly well hardwired in terms of what the money's for, but then it's tax-free, and it's a good way to build savings in order to buy into a boat. That's the quick definition of a CCF. It's not that simple, but that's close enough. Good enough for these purposes. Okay, back to Mr. Dithers. All the fishing assets are organized under an LLC, a limited liability company. Okay, and since everyone here watched the class on organizational structures last fall, you'll know what an LLC is. His total asset holdings under the LLC at the end of 2008 were $2.9 million. He has very little debt, less than $100,000. We'll show the balance sheet here in a moment. His business grosses $1.4 million annually with a net income of $1 million. So his costs are very low because he's not paying any debt on these things anymore. He's not paying for the boat anymore, it looks like. So he's able to take in most of that money. So his variable costs are pretty much what he's running here. They're putting maximum amounts into their IRA accounts. Again, that's the retirement planning component. But they still pay considerable income tax. And through funds and savings and the business itself, they have personal assets in excess of $5 million. So Arnie is currently fishing five of his permits except the Bristol Bay Drift. That one's sitting there. He hasn't fished that since 1998. And one of his boats is in Naknek. Okay, and it's in good condition. So they're looking to phase out of their current lifestyle and into one of more time for each other and to enjoy that second or third stage of their life. And the question is, what should they do? Before I jump into that too quickly, let me just flash the financials on this. And it's going to be tough to read, but maybe you can get to it. The first sheet I have up here is the balance sheet. Now, we all know what these things are because we've watched the previous classes on balance sheets and financial statements. Very very low holdings in current assets and current liabilities, but you can see the long-term assets. It's probably where to focus. They have $500,000 in vessel and equipment. They happen to have some real property of $85,000. His permits, all six of them, total $255,000. The IFQ that he owns is $1.3 million. The capital construction fund is at $78,000. Long-term investments are at $670,000. He's very little debt here, so most of this is equity. Most of this is equity. And if you guys have any questions or comments to add as we go through, just stop me and we'll do that. Here is an income statement that I broke it out by fishery, probably not necessary, but I did. And again, it's $1.4 million as a gross. This was just in 2008. Okay, so some pretty lucrative fisheries that he's involved in. And at the end of the day, he's making almost $1 million, actually $900,000. And this last sheet is the personal balance sheet for the Dithers. It is, again, not a lot of current assets sitting in the bank, but we see that the Dithers LLC is at $2.9 million. They've got some land and a home estimated at $1 million, retirement accounts at $1.3 million, and a couple of cars that value $55,000. And with just about $300,000 in loans on the house and on the land, they're looking at personal equity of about $4.8 million. So quite a bit here. I think we've approached the territory where in an estate planning situation, if this was a gifted, they would, or not gifted, but if it was turned over at death, it would accrue some tax. But so this is the dealers. I think they've got a good problem on their hand. And what would you suggest that they do to deal with this? They want to keep it in Fishburg. They would love to give it to the move it to their son, but there's no guarantees of that. And so what kind of process would you advise these folks take?
Well, as an LLC, are they planning on gifting some of the shares of the LLC to the children? And to me, that would be part of the discussion when you drafted up the paperwork for an LLC is who are the owners of the shares and how can you – it's easily transferred from one member to the other, gifted, as well as if you had an individual that was non-family that wanted to take over the business, could they actually buy out so many shares every year? This looks like some sizable incomes coming in every year. So to me, the one of the key points that we need to discuss is keeping that business going as opposed to letting it be sold off to some other party that maybe is more larger. I guess I'm not opposed to dealing with large farms and large corporations, but to me, the value to the family and to the community is to have that business ongoing to a younger individual that could continue to run the business and earn a living off that business. So to me, it was wise for them to develop the corporation and it makes it easier to transfer the assets of that corporation. I might add, it looks like Arnie and Vicky are maybe some Iowa farmers there, as opposed to being fishermen from Alaska.
Well, I see a few things that I probably would, if they came in and we visited, a few more questions we'd probably ask. But, if they're netting $1 million off their operation, I mean, that. I'm assuming that, they've probably depreciated a lot of their equipment and, they've got money in the CCF for a new boat. But really, they might be a little young to be thinking, which kid's going to really take over. The daughter could be married to a fisherman and be back in Fishburg, and the son, could go off to medical school and not have any interest. So, in some ways, you really don't know how it's going to break down for them. Probably, maybe even at the end of 10 years, they still might not know with the son now 27, maybe just now getting out, from college a couple of years, still doesn't know what he wants to do or where he wants to live. But with $1 million of income, you'd have to say, wow, we better make sure that we can really reduce that income as much as we possibly can. I mean, they don't qualify for things like Roth IRAs, or really, they probably wouldn't be doing regular IRAs. In a pension field, a planner would probably, their accountant or their financial planner would probably recommend maybe like an age-based retirement account where they could put, $100,000 each, maybe, or $100,000, or more for the husband who's working. I mean, obviously, if the son's 17 and working in the business, he's probably developing some income, and that's a good way to lower that income tax. Is a lot of people overlook the ability of paying their kids into well while they work out on the boat. Mm-hmm. So the son's probably could be working as a crew member and getting a crew share, and the son could be starting his own IRA, paying for his college, all those types of things. So, trying to get the maximum tax deduction is always something that accountants seem to spend a lot of time on. With a Roth IRA not available, a regular IRA only being $6,000 for him, or I guess he's over 50, so six. He probably would be looking for the pension that he could put the most money in to deduct as much of that off the federal income tax, because he's at the higher brackets, and unfortunately he's probably going to be going higher in the next few years, because he would be targeted with over 250 under the new tax, what's probably down the pike. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask, but I mean obviously there's there's places that you would look at for down the road, what's his insurability? Would he be able to have a life insurance plan, and would that life insurance plan be put in some type of irrevocable life insurance trust to get it out of his estate? Even though he might be subject to estate taxes if they both died at this point with a credit shelter trust, so that would be bringing an estate attorney in to it, so they each got their full estate tax credit. But next year, I guess that's, they won't, if they both died next year, it'd be the perfect year, there's no estate taxes. But at this point, estate taxes are going to fall down to $1 million unless Congress does something in the next couple of years to keep it up at $3.5 million or whatever. So there's concerns there, and I think probably the estate tax attorney would be thinking about, well, maybe we need to set some money aside for the potential tax bill and down the road potentially to even up the estate if the son decides to continue to fish and the LLC becomes so much more of the whole value of the couple, all those get turned over to the son, and now they're equal to 3/4 of the estate. What do you do about the daughter, you know, down the road? And still a lot of planning, but I think, you know, looking at, you know, some, I think you'd probably find some life insurance, maybe in an irrevocable trust, would probably be in their future if they were both insurable. Those would be some thoughts that that I would have right off the bat. Okay. Pay the son life insurance and maximum amount that they could get into some type of age-based retirement plan, kind of setting up more or less a defined benefit program for him and maybe his son, because other than that, he wouldn't have any other employees, more than likely. They'd all be contract workers, which would be out of the equation. So it'd be a perfect defined benefit retirement account that we'd be looking at, more than likely.
Oh, I see. Sonny, do you have any questions or thoughts on this? I've got a few, but I want to direct the camera at you at first.
Yeah, one thought or something to consider. I believe you would not be able to transfer the permit or the IFQ within the LLC to shareholders because of legal restrictions within the state of Alaska and the federal IFQ system. So those things would have to be transferred separately in some way. Just as we keep that in mind, because those corporations and LLCs seem like nice ways to transfer businesses, and yet you encounter a little bit of these stumbling blocks when you start talking about fishing permits. So maybe given that, Dave, with your experience, I don't know if there's something parallel in the farming world, but I can see sort of gifting those kind of assets or transferring them in some other way. But maybe if you had any thoughts on that.
I guess I wasn't aware that there would be laws as far as transferring the quotas, but I'm looking at their balance sheet just for the corporation. We're talking, you know, over $2 million, or almost $3 million in equity. So I guess I'd have to know more about the quota system and what is the value. I see IFQs are 1.3. Is that a value of that quota that can go up and down, similar to what, say, the grain produced on our farm would be?
It can. I'll field a couple of these, Sonny, and then turn it back to you if you want to add. IFQ will go up and down based on a number of factors: the market price for the fish, which has been good, the availability or the amount of harvest that's put out there, and I guess the health of the resource, whether there's large allocations or not. That'll change the value of that price. And with IFQ and permits, with state permits, you have to be an individual to actually, you know, have your name on the license or the permit. and so that does create a problem here with moving out an LLC that has permits and boats and IFQ. And with IFQ, there is some that can be owned by a corporation, but it's pretty big stuff. And so you don't see a lot of small boat fishing families that own the corporate IFQ shares. So I'm glad Sonny brought that up. That's an interesting thing that people are going to have to think about. I think there are things under the LLC that could be gifted as shares, the vessel likely enough, and some of these other assets. But yeah, you would have to think your way through that, through the permits and the IFQs. Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Randy?
Well, you know, I know why they've done that, to keep, big corporations and keep a lot of small businessmen doing business in Alaska as fishermen, which it was a great idea in a way, but it does complicate this. One thing I would say, I mean, being I'm about the same age as Mr. Dithers here or whatever, and I've got a son who's in high school, what I do see sometimes with father-son type relationships, sometimes the father is reluctant to talk to the son about taking over his business at an early age. You know, I don't want to force him into it. I don't want to make him feel like he has to fish. He can go on and do anything. But I don't see anything wrong with either the father's telling him, hey, son, I've got an operation here that is $1 million a year operation. And, obviously you don't have the skills, and I don't expect you to make a decision on it. But if you go off to college, just like where I grew up in Illinois, a lot of the kids who fathers own businesses in the farming area, the kids went into college, the University of Illinois, and studied farm business, basically. And I think, those kids... it was kind of a tradition, and they were proud to take over the farm. And I would just say, for a father or a grandfather to try to talk a son or a daughter, I mean, tell them all the benefits of it. And obviously they see it as kids growing up. But talk to them about owning the place. You know, this can be yours, and we can sell it. And I don't think at a 17-year-old, you'd want to take much what he said, with a grain as far as, yeah, Dad, I'll take it, don't worry. But I think, to be starting the conversation with a 17-year-old who's a senior in college or in high school, going off to college, would at least direct him on, boy, if you're going to do this, son, taking some accounting classes, taking this type of work in college will make this business grow even more when you come back in. And here's how... We'll talk about how I'll get it to you later, but start the conversation. So that pathway that Dave talked about, I think is a great idea. Even someone who's as young as, I think, 51, he's probably not thinking of his own demise too much, or his, retirement's just a number that I'll probably be thinking about it by the time I'm 60. Who knows, when he's 60, he might be having a lot of fun working it with his son, and they might work it together for another 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. So there's a mentoring component, showing some leadership and trying to keep it in your community. Does anyone else have a follow up on that particular point? Okay, I just have some questions here, Randy. Just for clarification, the IRA is it's not useful in this scenario because you can only put so much in it. And you said, right, it's 6,000 right now or whatever it is for a...
Yeah, okay. He would be able to do 6 and she'd be able to do 5. So it'd probably be, most fishermen are already using a simplified employee's pension, uh-huh. Simple IRAs,
right.
Some kind of profit sharing, 401k,
okay.
or a defined benefit.
So and this age-based retirement account, are there tax advantages to that?
Big tax advantages. Uh-huh. Whereas most pension plans, like a SEP, you're able to do about 20% of your profit, which, well, that's great. That's $200,000. Unfortunately, there's a cap of about $40,000.
Right, okay.
With defined benefits, you're basically saying, hey, I'm going to retire at approximately 60. So, and I want to have $5,000 a month guaranteed at that time. So it's more expensive, but you're putting away a lot more money, sometimes over $100,000. In 1 year, and every year an actuary looks at it and says, this is how much you need to make, put in this year to get that benefit down the end of the road. Usually those retirement vehicles for defined benefit are very conservative, meaning they're not heavily involved in stocks or bonds, because if the market falls out like this year, you might have to put in a huge block to make up for, to get that benefit back. So usually they're based on pretty conservative investments. But, you know, we've recently been in talks with a lot of people who say, I've got this. I know I'll probably have this income for this next few years. And I do really want to put as much as I can away because everything's paid for. We don't need $1 million to live on.
Right.
And is the money that you pull out at retirement, that's not tax-free? No.
Right. It would be taxable,
you know, just like an IRA, pre-tax going in.
Okay.
So he subtracts off his high tax bracket, but then when he's in retirement, he'll be withdrawing it, and sometimes at a lower tax bracket, sometimes the same, but he's got years of growing the money tax deferred, which is a real big benefit.
Gotcha. Okay. Another question, credit sheltered trust. Can you explain what that is? I mean,
it's a quick note with the IRS and this estate tax problem that people get into when they add everything up and it's over a certain amount. And for years it was $600,000. So a family who had $600,000 and the second death happened, in other words, husband passed it to the wife and then the wife passes on, she would get a $600,000 credit before she started. The rest of the estate started being applied for federal estate taxes. Well, under the recent administrations, they've ramped that up once again, worrying about families losing farms. Mm-hmm. And now it's up to, I think, $3.5 million, and next year it goes away completely. And then without any restructuring, I guess it goes back to $1 million. Well, with a credit shelter trust, basically you're trying to get two of those exemptions.
Okay.
Instead of, like, if I die and leave it to my wife in a I love you will, basically I've given up my credit.
Right.
You might say a credit shelter trust says I'll take part of those assets and put them in my name. And when I die, they go into a trust for the benefit of my wife. Ultimately, the benefactors to my kids in that situation. So, therefore, I get my credit of, say, $3.5 million or whatever it is, and then my wife would get hers as well. So, under that scenario, this couple today wouldn't have a taxable estate, whereas if they didn't use a credit shelter, they might have a couple $100,000 or a couple million that might be subject to a federal estate tax. Once again, that's a discussion that you'll have with an attorney. Not someone, I'm not licensed to practice law, but that's just generally, if you pulled it up on the internet, you'd read about the credit shelter trust and why they use them.
Okay. I understand. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions out there on this? Sonny, you have any questions?
Oh. Just two comments. And the one would be, of course, using the strategy of how do I adjust my income today to meet my needs 10 years from now. If Mr. Dithers is 51, he's thinking, well, in 10 years, what am I going to need for income for my retirement years or for whatever I'm doing? That's why it's so important to have a retirement specialist come in and use these tools that are available to alleviate some of the tax implications.
Did we lose Dave? The sunspots. Okay. Sounds like we lost Dave, and I don't know if we'll be able to get him back. Do you know? Okay. Okay. Well, we lost Dave, and he may be able to dial back. Sonny, did you have anything to add at this point here?
I had a question for Dave. I was hoping for folks to think about if there's some way to begin a transfer process with escape clauses, what are those escape clauses if the person that you're transferring to suddenly changes their mind?
Good idea. Good. Well?
Well, on, you know, part of the idea of, and you get into estate planning, and most of the conversations around this confiscatory tax that people will be subject to if they have more than the credit that the IRS gives them. And, you know, that's where you find very wealthy people starting to give away money to their children, their grandchildren, their grandchildren's spouses, their kids' spouses. And the IRS says basically you can give away a certain amount every year. And whether in this their case, whether they gave away, you know, a permit, I don't know. That doesn't make much sense in fishing because you have to fish it. But if they started saying, well, we own some land and I'm going to give my 20-year-old, I guess 22-year-old, $13,000 worth of something, and my wife's going to give $13,000 or Mrs. Dithers. So really each child, they can give away about $26,000 because a gift will come from the mother and the father. And the idea is to try to lower that taxable estate by pushing it into the next generation. Then there's a lot of strategies attorneys will use, or estate planning attorneys will use. But that's really the, you know, gifts. Sometimes you see family limited partnerships, things like that, where they're giving him shares of the partnership. And they can make gifts without that erasing from their credit down the road.
Oh, okay.
So that's where you usually see gifts and sometimes protecting then that estate. I mean, the Dithers are starting to get a pretty big estate. So you find things like, well, on the insurance side, do they have an umbrella policy that would protect them from a lawsuit or somebody, a deckhand or something that slips and falls getting off the boat and wants to come after them personally? You know, do they have enough insurance to cover that liability? Because he's now bringing in $1 million a year. That money, some of it's going to go in pension, but a lot of it's not. So to start making gifts early on, you do see that. And then there's crummy powers and things like that that you have to leave to the kids to have them to be able to pull that gift back within a certain amount of time after you give it. But that's what, I'm sure that's what would be the discussion an attorney would be having with these people. The estate's growing by $1 million a year or something like that. So you're going to project it out 10 years from now, no matter what the estate taxes is, they're going to be subject to some. Right. So getting that money out of the estate at this point would be a very good task for the attorney to work with.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. One other thing to point to here, just as a note, we do have some funds dedicated to a capital construction fund in here, and based on some research that I've done, I think you're pretty well bound to the rule of the capital construction fund, and so if there's $78,000 in here and you haven't used it, if you don't use that for a qualified withdrawal, you will be taxed at the highest tax rate possible for that year, and you may be subject to interest penalties too. So it's possible. I'm not certain, but it's possible that might be something that could be transferred if you work with the folks that know on that. But I'm not certain. It's definitely something you're going to want to look at. I had an opportunity to talk to a lady at a workshop one time, and her husband passed away, and he had money in a capital construction fund. She simply didn't know what it was for, and she used the money on business purposes, but later ended up having to pay a penalty and interest. And at the highest tax rate. So it is important for your successor to understand, to know, and get to work on that early, either use it up or figure out if you can find a way to minimize your tax. Sonny, your question was, and it's a good one, what do you do if your successor pulls out? And since we lost Dave and we can't answer that question or have that question answered, what I'll do is we'll contact Dave here and we'll get an answer to that, and I'll post it online somehow to everyone in the class and let people know his thoughts on that. Anyways, I think we're getting close to closing time. Maybe I can see if you have any final thoughts. Sonny, do you have anything to add here as we close it out?
I guess I'd say it's just basically reiterating what we've all been saying about communication being a key piece. In fact, probably the most important thing, I guess. I mean, that is in some ways an escape clause, as I was talking about. If the communication has been good from the beginning and there's a trust and communication relationship going on, the person who's the intended transferee, as they're changing their mind, we'll bring that up right away, and changes can be made, adaptations can be made in this transfer plan as it goes along. So I'd say that's crucial. And then the second point, I guess I hope folks will walk away with, is this thinking beyond your own business as you make decisions about what will happen when you are ready to retire. So the implications that it has in a community or within a family, and on your own pocketbook for tax considerations as well. But just thinking long term about where you want those assets to go, and hopefully deciding that there's value to that fishing business continuing where it is.
Thanks, honey. Randy?
Just a thought. I'm sure if you got into a discussion with the Dithers, Mrs. Dithers would be very happy that you brought up a lot of these questions. And you do see occasionally spouses that really do not want to talk about maybe the husband. It's an erroneous zone. The husband doesn't like going there. But having this outside party kind of start talking about, okay, well, what if you didn't make it in from fishing tomorrow? You know, we talk about succession plans that are involving kids, maybe grandkids or partners. How about tomorrow? You know, what if something happened tomorrow? I'm sure she would be very interested in, you know, what the plan would look like for her, because we're losing $1 million a year of income and we have some assets to sell. Mm-hmm. So I think she would be happy to join in on this conversation.
Good point. It sort of finishes on a personal note, because that's what it really is about a lot of times, is people and their lives, and it's very important. Well, that we're going to close out here. We're almost at the end of our time. And again, this is a huge subject. Each one of these components here could be in and of itself an hour, 2 hour discussion. And if you look at the resources I've got online, particularly the Oregon State Extension piece where they have day long workshops. Oh, thanks. Yeah. It's this second one here. Oregon State University Extension Business Succession is what it's titled. At any rate, like Dave and the Beginning Farm Center, they've got a lot of stuff on there that's really useful. And it just gives you an idea. They'll bring in professionals like Randy and show and walk through the various situations. It's a good thing.